accession number 20064, reel 3.
Ralph died, reel 3.
And the hospital train ended up in Durham, and the next day I was sent to Shotley Bridge Chest Hospital and had major surgery, and I gather it was pioneering surgery of the kind that they give to people who get lung cancer. I lost some of my lung and some ribs. And
which lung was that?
The left lung. Yeah. And eventually posted back to the artillery at Woolwich Depot in London.
What did you think of the medical treatment you got?
Excellent. Absolutely first class. The surgeon was Dr. Barnsley, and he was great, and we were wonderfully looked after. We were in a ward where all wounded from Normandy, but there are also German prisoners in the same ward being treated. One was a particularly nasty man, who was an SS man, and he was still tending to shout at the other Germans if he thought they were trying to fraternize with us. And I don't know what happened to him. I think he was moved out. And then we convalesced at Alnwick in Northumberland. They took over a wing of the mental asylum there. And quite a pleasant kind of 2 or 3 weeks of recuperation. And then I had a rather wretched time in the Woolwich Depot, nobody wanting me, and the unit back at Carrow's were full complement, and they didn't have many landings left. I think at that time they were just about to do the Valkran Island landing. And after that, it was pretty well the end of amphibious operations because the fighting had moved inland. And I ended up in the intelligence corps.
Doing what?
Doing field security.
In England?
I was trained in England at Wentworth Woodhouse outside Rotherham in Yorkshire. And then shipped to Germany at the end of 1945. I spent several months around depots in England, not being very happy about things, but finally sent to the intelligence corps. It must have been beginning of 1945, and I ended in Germany as a field security sergeant doing denazification work. And
what did that involve?
Finding and arresting Nazis in hiding over a certain arrest category, because this is where the Führer Prinzip of Hitler came to bear, that if you found a member of the SA, and he was above, say, I've forgotten what it was exactly, the rank of Scharfuhrer. You knew that he was arrestable for some reason or other, so any Gestapo you found, or SS. And there were automatic arrest categories. If they were below this, then you just sort of made note of it and kept an eye on things as best you could. We functioned fairly openly. We were the English Sicherheitsdienstes. I did a German language course, by the way, at that time in an army school. And by the end of 19, I started in Plön in Schleswig-Holstein, where they were processing mountains of captured Nazi documents. It was one of that and the redoubt around Berchtesgaden, where the Nazis ended up. And we were going through a lot of processing documents. And then I was moved to Osnabrück, which became a major army center after in the BAOR, and worked in that area of the Emsland and Lower Saxony. And I was there, I came out of the army in February 47. I got an exemplary discharge, which was quite unusual and surprised me, because I'd committed, you know, my ration of usual minor offences when I was a soldier. But I got an exemplary discharge, and I was very proud of. And then I was recruited by the Foreign Office as an intelligence officer, doing the same work.
Before we go on to that, can you give me more details about the denazification work in Germany, please?
Yeah, it was entirely in the hands of the occupation army and the military government for the first, oh, I suppose, 18 months or so. Then they handed the whole process over to the Germans, to denazification committees of of Germans, and they processed the people through the system. So that after about 18 months, we were no longer involved directly in it. And I used to get a lot of my information from the Social Democratic Party in Germany, the SPD, which had offices in most of the towns around about. And were only too anxious to pass information to us about Nazis in hiding. And
how had you come into contact with them?
Oh, we used to just go down, and they knew we were working for the intelligence corps. And the English Secret Service had this incredible reputation on the continent of being omnipotent and omniscient and infallible and everywhere. And of course we weren't. you could trade on that. And they were quite happy to pass us information. We got quite a lot. And then after that, it was just about then that they started to reintroduce democracy into Germany, and they did it by starting up committees. Did you want me to go on with this?
Please.
And the committees had to submit lists of their members to military government for approval so that no Nazis were allowed to sort of practice. It's very difficult because most people had been in any kind of position during the Nazi time had been forced to join the Nazi party, or, you know, if you were a Beamter or a civil servant, you had to join the Beamter organization, or you didn't get a job. I mean, so a lot of the effective people had been Nazis. The question was how dangerous had they been in our terms, or what rank had they been, and we weeded them out. And it was the days before computers, and we relied on a massive card index which they'd found in a salt mine down in South Germany somewhere. And it took days to get any kind of reply or request for confirmation. But you could tell from two things. One, if they joined the party before 1933, they were bad guys. In 1933, the Nazi Party opened up its membership and closed it again until 1937. And if anybody came into the party in those intervening years, he'd done something that had attracted attention to the Nazis. You know, he'd done something admirable in their point of view. And so if we found anybody like that, then we automatically sort of did something about them. And then after 37, the party again expanded. And I think in total they had about 8 million members altogether. That was the setting up of democracy in Germany. And we were sent to various political meetings and just sort of listening in and making situation reports, periodic ones. And then the next real development, of course, was the Jean Le Carré stuff, you know, Smiley and all that sort of stuff, the development of the Cold War.
And just before we go on to that, which were these political parties making?
Well, the Social Democratics, SPD started out, the CDU, and then a number of other parties. There was the Free Democrats, which were the liberals. And then the refugees started a party. There were 10 million refugees in the West, you know, from Silesia and places. And I worked quite a lot among refugees from the East, because quite often you could get very good information, particularly after the Cold War started, you know, about places the other side of the curtain. And particularly if they just arrived, there was a constant flow of people in. And they were the main parties. The communists, you know, they lost nearly all their membership in concentration camps during the war, and the KPD was in existence on a small scale, and we vetted them pretty obviously with the Cold War coming on. We had a close look at them.
And what did the vetting consist of?
Oh, what did it consist of? I think fairly close surveillance as far as we were able to. We knew there weren't many of them, and we knew the leaders, and they'd been cooperating with us on the denazification period, because again, like the socialists, they were very keen to get the Nazis rounded up. And but they weren't terribly important, I don't think, the KPD, not then.
Were there any particular obstacles to the setting up of a democratic system in Germany, from what you observed?
No, I don't think so. The the Germans and the British were just so thankful that they hadn't been taken over by the Russians, and they were so pleased to be under the British, and they genuinely wanted democracy. I mean, a lot of Germans had been just as occupied as the French had been occupied by the Nazis. They felt freedom, and they were definitely going to try and have a go at it this time. Of course, the new Grundgesetz, as they call it, the Constitution. And do you speak German?
No. I know a few words.
You're right. Which was based on the Weimar Constitution, really, with some of the sort of failings of that constitution taken out. And that's the constitution they sort of operate under today. And it was in its infancy then. And no, it started off at the low levels, at the level of the town municipal government. Then it gradually evolved up the line to the provincial government, the Landes government. And then in due course, when was it, about 1948, the West German government came into being, and there were three zones, the Russian-American and in the West, the French, the American, the British, and they all developed. I'm a bit hazy on this. I think it developed mainly out of economic necessity. They had to just, the politics followed the economics. They just couldn't leave this vacuum in the middle of Europe. I mean, Britain was being asked to feed about 10 million Germans a day at the time when they had acute food shortages in Britain itself. I mean, and my most vivid memory of 1948 was when the currency reform came in, the Währungsreform. And that came in over one weekend in 1948. And in those days, I was in an officer's mess in Osnabrück. And I know that weekend we were having a mess party, and I wanted the grand piano moved from one room to another. And I went downtown to Osnabrück to get a piano moving company. And we did the usual sort of barter arrangement. What would I take? Money was valueless. So I would give them so many cartons of cigarettes or something, and they would send a gang of men to move the piano for us. And that was done. And then over the weekend, the currency reform came in, and we had no inkling of this at all. I mean, up till that weekend, if you walked down a street in Osnabrück, there were empty shop windows, nothing in the windows, and anything people wanted, they bartered for on the black market or whatever. And the refugees were in a parlous state. I mean, many of them just wore the clothes they'd arrived in. They had no cookery pots. They were living in the households of West Germans, sort of eingeboren of West Germans, and lots of friction must have developed. And they couldn't lay their hands on anything, the necessities of living. And then the currency reform came in. On the Monday morning, it was an absolute transformation. It was as though the whole energy of the German people had been released. I mean, the hammers were ringing away, the shovels were out shoveling away, the bomb rubble. Every window in the street had goods, God knows where they'd gotten them from. Suddenly, money had value. They froze all the bank accounts. They gave everybody so much, small amount of money, and they said, right, now make it work and go to work. And it was most impressive. Well, the first thing that happened was this man from the piano company was on my door demanding to be paid in the new money, and he couldn't believe that I had none. I said, I was just as surprised as you were. Here's my wallet. I've got no money in it. You know, when I get some, I'll see to it that you're paid. And that was how surprising it was. And that was what the Germans call the Wirtschaftswunder, the great miracle of the German Mark, which has, of course, been strong ever since. Yeah. But I left shortly after that to take up teaching. That was the end of my career.
But what was this intelligence work that you were involved in after the army?
It was the Control Commission, Foreign Office. They recruited intelligence officers, mostly from field security people. And they gave us a 5-year contract, very good salary, free messing. And at the end of 5 years, 1 year's salary as a bonus. That was the conditions.
What were you supposed to do?
Well, much the same kind of work. Security, you know. We were one of the remits was to keep our eye open for any sign of an opposition, a Widerstandsbewegung, you know, and there wasn't one. There was a thing called the Wehrwolfs, which was turned out to be nothing. It was something the Nazis conjured up out of their kind of sort of fantasy world. They would be staying behind and they would be wreaking vengeance on the Allies, and there was never any trace of it. I think the Germans were just so utterly weary of the whole business.
So this was in the Osnabrück area that you
were doing? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but they, I mean, of course, the organisation covered the whole of the western zones. The Americans, I worked with the Americans for a while in Bremen, and the French had their own setup, and they each had their own methods, you know.
What were their methods?
Well, there were some apocryphal tales about the French. There was one two sad-looking characters standing over there in the corner, and they were sort of the kind of people we were just sent off to one of our interrogation areas. But these were headed for the Foreign Legion, I gather. You know, I heard. But they had more cause to be extremely... you see, the British had never been occupied, neither the Americans, and there wasn't this tremendous sort of vengeful kind of feeling about it. Everybody was so war-weary at the end. I think they were just glad to sort of... But the French, of course, you can understand, they'd been occupied by the Nazis. They'd had all the awful things happen to them. And one thing I did do in the intelligence, I worked on the Dutch frontier at one time, and we used to work with the Dutch Maréchaussée on frontier intelligence at Nordhorn and Bentheim. Which is one of the major rail crossings now from Holland into Germany.
What did that involve?
Oh, liaising, but there was a special frontier intelligence set up for vetting people crossing backwards and forwards across the border. And I was in the doing routine area intelligence of the kind I do anyway. Just happened to be up against the border there. And just area intelligence, just developing a kind of information network, which was easily done. You just met some key people and looked at your records and so on, and made situation reports.
Was this to stop wanted people crossing?
Yeah. They'd be on the lookout for SS trying to escape. And
what feelings about the Germans did this period in the occupation of Germany leave you with?
We used to come, it was mixed feelings. I mean, there were some awful people who used to come in and denounce people because they wanted to gain some kind of advantage. It was a terrible time. It was called the hunger time, and people were very deprived of things, food particularly. And the other thing was, I made some very good friends. I mean,
what kind of people?
People who'd been on the left side of politics, socialists. And there are a number of those people we met. I mean, a great many Germans were not involved with the Nazis, you know, mentally, and the civilized kind of Germans. There were people like that, and you met them. And I found them very nice people. But then you met the awful people, and the ex-Gestapo and ex-SS, and you had feelings of revulsion about them, you know.
Do you remember any specific individuals?
No, I don't. No. It's too long back.
Yeah. How do you feel now about having been in the Royal Artillery during the war?
Oh, now I feel quite proud about it. I feel particularly proud about having been with 48 Commando. See, there was D-Day acquired much more significance as the years went by, because at the time, the fighting rolled on inland, and all right, the landing had been important. I mean, that was the landmark we'd all been waiting for all those years, the Second Front. But then the fighting moved into the, you know, into Germany and up into Holland. But it was after the war that it became sort of a key kind of thing, that the D-Day landing had acquired some kind of dimension and perspective about it, I think. But I was cut off from the 48 Commando because I was wounded and I got into this other activity. And As far as I was concerned, they'd been disbanded at the end of the war. I didn't know where they were, if they existed, or anything about them. And I found, years later, I was in Toronto, I migrated to Canada in 1957, and I went to a D-Day officers' dinner organized by a colleague of mine at this university I was teaching in. And I met Jeff Linnell, Captain Jeff Linnell. And he was wearing a commando tie with a commando dagger on. And I said, you know, who are you, what unit were you with? And he said, 48 Commando. And I said, well, that's who I was with. And he said, I don't remember you. And I said, well, you probably wouldn't. I was on the artillery, the FOB, the Forward Officer Bombardment, OP. And I told him where I'd been with him and sort of blow by blow, step by step. And he sort of invited me to his place, and so he said, I've got all the records. He turned out to be the man who kept the 48 Commando Association going. He was, and did until two or three years ago, 40-odd years. And he said, come over and see all the records. And to me, this was 20 years later, and more like 25 years later. And he said, you know, we go there every year, don't you? And I thought, oh, God, they can't keep this sort of thing going all these times. And I decided I was going to keep in contact with him, and I realized I'd lost the address he'd given me, and I didn't. So the next thing I knew, the 50th anniversary came up, and I thought I'd like to just go back once and see what it was like, and did, and bumped into this crowd of 48 Marine commandos doing exactly that, doing their annual thing, but having a special ceremony that year on the beach at Saint-Aubin. And that's where I sort of, the Sergeant Major remembered me, which made me feel like about 10 men, you know, and this is lofty. I remember you, you know, because I felt very much an outsider. I wasn't in the commando itself. But since then, I've been on two or three occasions when they've met, including when they put the memorial up in Portsmouth 2 years ago. I flew over from Canada and met them again, and then I realized I was very much accepted by them as one of them. And this is why you are here today, I gather, that one of them, you know, passed my name to you. Yeah.
And what rank did you have in Normandy?
In Normandy, I was a Lance Bombardier.
And so, just to get the names of some of these units correct, you were in number 3 Bombardment Unit, RA.
That's right.
Which was attached to 48 Royal Marine Command.
That's right, yes.
And before that, you said that you were in the artillery section of the Glider Pilot Regiment.
No, the Glider Pilot Regiment is a separate regiment. I was in the 6th Airborne Division, Air Landing Light Regiment of the Royal Artillery. And I can't remember the number. I think it was 151. It was the Worcestershire Yeomanry, I remember that. Air Landing Light Regiment. Incidentally, the section of the Glider Pilot Regiment I was with went to Arnhem as co-pilots, and every single one of them was killed except one. And an extraordinary coincidence, when I started teaching, I went to a residential teacher training college, and this one man was in the next bed to me in the dormitory, and he'd been in the next bed to me in the glider pilot regiment, in the training battalion. And he was a man called Truman. He was the only survivor of the whole glider pilot regiment, his particular section on it. And something like 30 were killed. They were used as infantry defense perimeter for headquarters at Arnhem. Yeah.
And did you make a full recovery from what you had been through in Normandy?
It took time. It took me a couple of years before I could play tennis. And I started to play cricket about the time I started at teacher training college in 1950. And at college, I was captain of the tennis team. And I don't remember I was captain of the cricket team. I did all right. I made the odd 50 and things like that. I went to Birkbeck College, London University, about 2 years later, and I played for them. I started playing soccer about then. It took me about 6 years to be fit enough to play soccer, about a couple of years to play tennis. And for a while, I was very stiff and sore and didn't run about very much. But I wasn't fit to be a commando anymore.
Did you get any kind of pension?
Yeah, that was a funny story. I did, at first, I was paid 7 shillings and 6 pence a week for 5 years. And I got married, and they increased it by a shilling in respect of wife, they said. And then they discontinued it because I was clearly, you know, getting better, and I didn't bother. And then about 53 years later, after I'd been on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, and I bumped into a lot of the commanders, and they were all getting pensions for various bits and things, deafness and some real injuries and so on. And I was developing a kind of shortness of breath for some reason, and I went to my doctor and said, could this be attributable to the war wound? And he said, well, I care, it might very well be, because you've got reduced capacity in that lung. And I did a board over in Canada, and I thought they'd turn me down. And the strange thing was, we were here, and we just bought a new car when we came over. And I was having to scratch around to find the extra money for the car. And I suddenly got this check in the mail for £1,000, and it was 54 years at 8 shillings and 6 pence a week. And I get a small disability pension now, which is very useful. Yeah.
What about psychological scars?
Yeah, I think for a while I was, I don't know how you describe it, slightly unbalanced, anxiety ridden. It did affect me for a while. I think I started to settle down better when I got married in my early 1950s.
What symptoms did you have of that?
Oh, I was tense, I think, and a very quick mentality, as you may gather. And I think I was tending to shrink away from any confrontational kind of situation because I felt fragile down my left side, and, you know, and that would affect my personality, but I don't have the vocabulary for this kind of stuff, and I don't know.
What do you think about the accuracy of your memories?
I think they're quite vivid. I think I remember clearly everything I've told you today. And if I haven't been clear, I think I've said so. I mean, I can't give you absolute chapter and verse. It's so long ago, and I couldn't remember many names from that time. And my problem with you is I really didn't know many of 48 Commando. I was with them and removed from them very quickly. And in fact, the ones I know today are the ones I've met in the process of the last 2 or 3 years since I met up with them again. Yeah. I remember that when I was in hospital in Shotley Bridge and the various units, there were tank corps guys who'd been blown up. But when I said I'd been with 48 Commando, there was a kind of awestruck thing, my God, were you, you know, because the word was out that we really had a bad time, and they became part of the mythology, I think, of D-Day. You know.